It's by Jane Hirschfeld, and it's called Optimism. More and more, I have come to admire resilience, not the simple resistance of a pillow whose foam returns over and over to the same shape, but the sinuous tenacity of a tree finding the light newly blocked on one side, it turns in another. Repeating that. Not the simple resistance of a pillow whose foam returns over and over to the same shape, but the sinuous tenacity of a tree, finding the light newly blocked on one side, it turns in another. A blind intelligence, true, but out of such persistence arose turtles, rivers, mitochondria, figs, all of this resinous, unretractable earth. So we are in a time, you know, when the cultivation of resilience, a kind of optimism that is not an optimism based on a certain outcome, but a kind of optimism that is willingness to meet life as it is, and meeting life as it is from the Dhamma. It's much harder to meet life without any kind of view like that, because then you tend to have your view of life be determined by what you encounter. But in the Dharma's point of view, there's a larger view. There's something that holds it all. It holds it all. The moments that are pleasant, the moments that are unpleasant, the suffering, the joy, the uncertainty, the lack of anxiety, the anxiety, it holds it all. It holds it all. And that's because the well-being that of the Buddha is a well-being that is not based on conditions, but rather it is a well-being that is lodged in the unconditional. Some of the nine bodies work that's going on now, it's described as well-being, even well-being when there's not well-being, or the well-being without well-being. So that there is this level of meeting life, this level of finding ourselves, that we cease to demand that life be other than it is. That doesn't mean in the least that we don't strive to have beyond the definingness of this COVID-19. Of course we try. It doesn't mean that we don't do everything possible to keep as many people alive as we have, but that where we are resting back in, this resting in the knowing, is meeting all of those natural heart responses from this place that's a well-being that's not objecting to conditions being as they are. Doesn't mean there that the conditions are fair. It doesn't mean that conditions are equally spread, that there's kindness motivating, that there's the proper priority as we would see it. There's not any requirements like that for this well-being. It's quite different. So, COVID-19, like a major tsunami, has brought so much misery onto this world, and in the form of sickness, in the form of death, in the form of worry and fear of sickness and death. So much misery like this. It's also made so many people afraid of other people. It's interesting to watch who can pass you by and just keep proper distance, but be friendly and be available, and who can't, who have to close you off. I make a practice of, I wave at everybody that I pass, and some people are happy to wave back. Some people really try to ignore it altogether. And if they're really super involved in trying to ignore it, I really persist. And so that they have that there's a sense of there's, you know, that song about, you know, hello in there, you know, there's someone, and said, it's that same feeling about this, And I've become passing by, you know, socially distancing acquaintances with a number of people in my neighborhood because I walk every day. And I insist on the contact in this passing way. And so that I don't want to be afraid of others, and I don't want them to be afraid of me. I will turn. So I walk with my face away from them. If it seems at all too close, if there's not more than 6 feet, I will step off to the side. I'll do all of these things, but I won't not be friendly. But I don't want them to say anything back or anything like that. I want to exude friendliness in this meta sense of that word without a demand back in any way. So likewise, our economic desolation has followed in the wake of this tsunami of the COVID-19. And the economic desolation has in turn created a wake of anxiety and uncertainty about financial survival, about being able to feed oneself and take care of oneself. And in many instances, really not happening around the world. So this too is part of the life, the part of the world in which are we going to honor the possibility of having a well-being, or would it seem like guilty, like shameful to have a well-being that's in this way? And this COVID-19 has also brought isolation. It's brought this sense of not being able to be productive in so many ways. It's reduced for many people, but not all, work satisfaction. It's increased loneliness. It's created too much time for fretting, too much time to review one's shortcomings or to realize the mistakes of one's life. And I've sat and listened to people reporting these experiences. Is that their only alternative? I would hope not. And how do I listen? How do I listen? Do I listen from well-being, or would it be inappropriate to have a sense of well-being when listening to suffering? Which would serve them most? Which would serve them? Which would make me more available to have wise response, to listen with kindness, for them to feel through these, you know, these electronic devices, caring? So what is it here? What is the consideration? The practical considerations we know. You know, and we could also talk about the all those for whom it's been a great time. I know people personally who have individually, personally, been really happy. I mean, just having a great time. I also have spoken with a number of people that they have been so grateful for the fact that this has given them a chance to know their children, saying that they would never have known their children. They would never have had this connection had they not had the time, because they'd missed it earlier. And it was the momentum of their lives was never going to allow this connection. And these children, of course, are never going to be the same. Their whole life will be changed by having had parents that deeply connected in a way they had not. So what about them? And what about those who've gained a new clarity about what they want to do? People tell me about that too, about where they're going from here. Or likewise, people will say, we realized, my spouse and I, that we really were kind of living parallel lives, but this has actually brought us together. And it's amazing because we really like each other. Like, what happened? Why weren't we in this kind of connection? So, like, are they doing something wrong, these people with their kids, because they're happy, or someone who's just happy because their home environment is better than their work environment, and they like working at home? Are they doing something wrong by having happiness? What are we doing here? What are we doing? What is the appropriate response, to use a Zen phrase, to these circumstances? Is appropriate response based on the specifics of a condition, or is an appropriate response further back into a general orientation. And from that general orientation, then one acts appropriately. It's a big difference in that way. It's a big difference. And we could also, if we must, and sooner or later we must, focus on the inadequacy of those who were responsible for preparation of this, for those who were responsible for responding to it, for the slowness, for the failed response, for the even reluctant to acknowledge in response, which is like mind stopping, to be reluctant to acknowledge, to even begin to respond. What do we do with those? How do we respond to that? Do we respond with a kind of bitterness, a kind of resentment, a condemning? Is that productive? It doesn't mean that we don't vote people out of office. It doesn't mean that we don't fire people. It doesn't mean that in many instances we don't hold them guilty of criminal activity, because all of those have occurred in that level. So the level of inappropriate behavior is almost beyond measure around the world. But then how do we meet that? What is our inner experience as we're dealing with all of that? Do we get caught up in it? Is condemning the only way of being? Is anger the only way of being? So we all have to ask ourselves, well, what do we want to do? What is my response is in my moments of my life, internal, in my environment, and then external in the world, and the whole environment of the world, because this, we are experiencing this as a world. Where do we start? From the Buddhist point of view, as I would understand it, we cultivate this idea that this realm is like it is. And when the Buddha says in the First Noble Truth, there is dukkha, he is pointing to layers and layers and layers of understanding. There is dukkha. The nature of this realm is that it's interwoven with dukkha, this unsatisfactoriness, this unrelyingness, this ever-changingness in ways we would prefer not, as just as well ways we do prefer, that it's all interlaced, it's interwoven, it's not separate. There is dukkha. The nature of this realm is like this. So therefore, this realm, hard to accept, is not a mistake. So the dukkha is not a mistake. Any given moment of it, out of volition, is an act of unskillfulness, a lack of awareness, a lack of not being, an indication of being caught in greed, hatred, and delusion. Every individual act of that. But the nature of the realm, in my experience at least, is like this. Name a time it wasn't like this. Where? What do we have of that? Where would we think that? Could we do better? Of course we can do better in theory. And at times, have we done better than others? Maybe at least for some groups of people in some societies, but not necessarily every group of people in that society, not at all. So we have to be very careful not to forget the First Noble Truth, that there is dukkha. Following that opening to the levels of that there is dukkha, we really come to the opposites. That the Buddha's worldly winds of praise and blame, gain and loss, fame and ill repute, pleasant and unpleasant, all of that, this is the nature of this realm. And so right now, we all are called upon, from, again, my point of view, to consciously bear the difficulty of this realm. but not to bear it as like it's a nightmare, but to bear it as it's its nature, and we are going to respond to it as best we can, even if it were the extinction of all human life. We would fight every way in the world to have that not occur, and we would have lament that it is occurring, but we would not have to contract into that extinction. It's that extreme. It's that extreme that we don't have to contract. And I start with using the large because somehow it can be much tougher when it's us that's going to be extinguished, when it's our life that's going to be over. We can not be willing to face that at all. So this well-being that is not conditioned on well-being being present in the external, or even in the inner space in the mind, this well-being is willing to accept and be present for this life as it is. And then I am willing to bear the dukkha of this realm. I therefore am fully available to meet this realm from my heart capacities, the very same heart capacities I ask you to be in touch with in the meditation. Why? Because I don't have to turn my face. I don't have to disappear. I am willing to be present and make whatever decisions I can, as best I am able, as to what's the appropriate response, and to make it a priority, even if it inconveniences me, even if it challenges me in various ways, but whatever response I'm capable of making. And there's not some standard definition of what's the appropriate response. There's not some standard definition of the amount you give or how much risk you put yourself in, but rather the exchange is organic and it's alive and ever present in whatever manner it's present. It's just there now. So we can't, it's a very strange situation that we're in, because we can't go out and help on the streets, or we can't do anything like this. We can do things with money. We can do certain things with our time. It turns out we probably could do a lot more with our time than maybe many people are, if nothing else in the political arena. One could be doing things with one's time, or one could be doing things with one's time with one's family, the family members that are more distant, that have no one that they have contact with. There's so many ways, small and large, to serve. I have been more busy in terms of, that's not the word, I've not been busy, that's not right at all, that's sloppy language. I have been more scheduled during this time period than I was before it, because it's various conditions have come together with people in different time zones, and I'm meeting various time zones various ways. So I've been really scheduled, quite heavily, in doing my small little way of helping. Just mine. And it's definitely small, but it's mine. It is within my range of experience. And as best I am able, meeting it with well-being. When I'm hearing really terrible stories, when I'm hearing happy stories, to have my well-being not based on, oh, this is all good news, and so I can just be in a good mood because it's this person's really in a good mood, or, oh, this person's really miserable, I'm supposed to feel miserable back. But no, it's not, because it's not karuna. This compassion is not a kind of a becoming in sync with the misery, the hurt, but rather being having this heart's response to it, the heart's quiver, as the Buddha tells us. So what is well-being for you? What is well-being? We're here, we're isolated in this way. Is this an opportunity to do those reflections on death? those four reflections, or some traditions, five reflections on death. Maybe, I don't know. Is this a time to let loose of a grudge that you've held? Is it time for you to let loose of a story of if only, or because I did this, to let loose of, oh, you know, yes, I could have made such a difference if I had just, you know, listened to someone. And it's true. It would have made a difference. We don't really know how that then would have turned out. That's a little trick with that. We sometimes think, well, it would have all turned out great, but that road could have been much more treacherous than the road you took. So one wants to be careful about those, making up stories beyond the moment that you didn't make a choice. But letting loose of even that, you're not letting loose of history, but you're letting loose of history define you. History as you tell it to yourself, your interpretation. To say, to look for the Buddha's well-being in the course of this pandemic, the inner feeling of well-being as you respond appropriately to the outer conditions, so that the inner conditions become more and more, have a freedom from pleasant and unpleasant, that you're finding this freedom, that this well-being that is non-conditional in nature. You know, so often I have in my own life gone through something difficult. As you know, I've gone through 4 years of really being unhealthy. And as each of those years, the more that one challenge after another came up, the more and more my well-being grew. And it was the well-being not based on conditions. My objection to conditions grew less and less in this time frame. And it was interesting then when I would get caught. I went through a period of time caught about really inferior medical care, because it wasn't within the social contract. And I didn't think that was right. And I really got angry about that. Like somebody should do something about this. Maybe I should do something about it. But it was so clear to me in those weeks that I had that as a predominant experience, that wasn't doing me any good. And if I was going to do something about this, that was not the effective way to do it. And so just this letting go. And also the same way, when you meet people that are, their conditions are so much better than yours, to be happy for them, because you're more and more oriented to the well-being that includes non-well-being. You know what you're about. It doesn't mean you're delivering, but you have an orientation that's your practice. And as I said in the meditation, for the practitioner, every moment in life is a moment of practice. And not in some highfalutin way or rigid way, but organically in the flow of the moments that, oh, here. And not perfectly. Those are all enemies. Perfection is enemy. The paramis, which are called the perfections, I call attainments for that very reason. Because the perfections imply that it's the ego that is doing. It is only perfected in our humility, not in our great capacity for me. So this is what I would leave you with tonight, and I'm going to take some comments or questions here. But how do you cultivate this well-being that's not based on conditions? And then as far as conditions go, get as much well-being as you can that's not causing harm to others or to yourself. That's great. Move the chairs around on the Titanic as much as you can to enjoy the sun and the ocean views while you can, but not being deluded that it's more than that, that we're not in the end going to control. And it's so amazing that we collectively, you know, showed such inadequacy in controlling this in responding to the COVID-19. As we've seen, because some people have responded, some cultures, some nations have responded so well, and others not so well, and others plain all terrible. We can't organize ourselves. This is the nature right now. It's like this. This is the culture we live in. Our nation's like this. It's not just those people. We as a whole are a nation. We're not separate from them. We don't get to have a separate culture. And the reason you know that is because you're experiencing the same thing as everybody else. There's a pandemic and you're having to respond to it. So you don't get to be separate. It's such good teaching right now. There's been these things, one in particular floating around the internet, where it's talking about how the nature's coming back with all of us sheltered in place. And it is with this, we're just reminding you that you're just a visitor here. And very, very, and so to be a responsible guest while you're here. So many lessons to be taken from this. So again, this well-being, like, is in what way does these circumstances allow me to let loose of the way I hold preference? Not let loose of all preference, but how I hold preference to move towards through wise intention, the wholesomeness of wise intention, to this kind of well-being that can receive it all. And the trouble with the good times, those of who are having good times, if they're identifying with those good times, you see, they're setting up their future suffering in this moment, because those win too. And it's important to remember that sometimes when you're feeling, oh, look at them and not me. The dukkha is interwoven. It can't be avoided. It cannot be avoided. Yeah, there's so many smart people that have tried to solve this over so many thousands of years. The way out is the way through. The way out is the way through. Here's the wisdom of Kung Fu Panda. The mind is like dishwater. The mind is like dishwater, my friend. When it's agitated, it becomes difficult to see. But if you allow it to settle, the answer becomes clear. One often meets his destiny or her destiny on the road he or she takes to avoid it. Master Oogway. I never saw a Kung Fu movie, so I don't really know what it's about, but I just like that line, that the mind is like dishwater. So in this regard, then, what would you have to say for yourselves? And I think in the past, have you just let people speak up, or do you use that thing about raise your hand? I'm looking over here at the people I know. How does this work?
We've done it both ways. Unfortunately, I've got like three screens to patrol here, so it's a little bit difficult to try to look for raised hands.
All right. So if they use the thing down here at the bottom, will that do it? We see it no matter what screen they're on, right?
I get to see that somebody has raised her hand, but I don't know where she is.
Oh, I see. All right, we'll just go try to do this by. I'm really glad to know this, because we didn't do this. I just did a 4-day retreat a couple of weeks ago, and we didn't take any questions.
Well, we have three, you know, we've got 66 people, 65 people tuned in, so it's a little bit hard to.
Okay.
My suggestion is that we go on the trust basis, and if somebody has a question, unmute yourself. But if you start colliding with other people, see if you can back off. So
let's do it. Someone start us. Jan, are you going to start us?
Question.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm not really grokking the idea of the felt sense of wholesome intention.
Yes.
Wholesome is like a positive quality, and in some sense a judgment. you know, so that how does it become a felt sense?
I am so glad you're asking this. Thank you for asking it.
Yeah, because I'm just not grokking it.
All right. So intention is wise intention. So there in the Buddha's teaching, there is wholesome rather than unwholesome. There is that difference. So the Buddha is referring to the world of duality in that way. You know, this the dukkha, that duality of the eight worldly winds. The First Noble Truth reflects that there's this duality, and in this duality, so we don't know what to do, and we're going to have pleasant and unpleasant happens, all of this, and so we're also going to make mistakes, everything. So we, in so far as we can, we intend not to cause suffering. In so far as we can, we intend to be kind. In so far as we can, we intend to practice having restraint, to renunciation, so that out of lust or anger or boredom, we don't cause suffering to ourselves or another. The wholesome intention is, it's not judgment, but rather discernment. So right view equips us for wisdom to discern what's wholesome and unwholesome. It's not a judgment of like, oh, you're a bad person or you're a good person, but rather this feeling of, insofar as I can, I choose non-harming over harming. And the felt sense of that, and why I point to this, and this is so, oh, I'm so pleased with you asking this, is that it's not a mental construct. That's you know, that's back to the Ten Commandments. It's a felt sense in this moment. This is how I wish to be in this moment. It's not from a point of view of being judged by others. It's from the point of view of your own feeling of well-being. That the wholesome intention is such a resting place, just as resting in the body is a resting place, resting in knowing is a resting place. Wholesome intention is, and you feel that, like, you know the teachings about the bliss of blamelessness, right? So in that same way, the wholesome intention is leading us towards blamelessness. It is, there's a sense of, look, okay, I don't know what's the right thing to do here necessarily, but I do know how I'm meeting it. I know the values that I'm meeting with, and I'll do as well as I can, but I'm not confused about the end result's not more important to me by the means by which I get there. I won't do unskillful means to get to something I think would really be really good if I have.
Yes. Thank you.
That makes some sense. What's your dog's name?
This one is Layla.
Hi, Layla.
The famous of Layla and Majnun. And this one is Whimsy.
Oh, hi, Whimsy. All right. Well, thank you. Thank you for introducing. Hi, Wendy. Let's go with you next. Wendy, are you speaking?
No. Liz, no.
Wendy, it looks like you're still on mute. You must be muted on your end, not in the Zoom.
Well, we'll let you work on that a moment. We'll go ahead, Liz, and then we'll come back.
You were asking for topics for Poetry Day, and did you get my email?
Yes, I did. I sent it. I thought I sent you one back. I'm pretty sure. Well, all right. Yeah. No, I got it.
Okay.
You had a big effect on me.
Good. I'm glad. I'm glad I did. So my theme for Poetry Day was joy and love in spite of everything, and you will change it to whatever you wish. But that was my suggestion. But and you will, I'm sure, put it in much better words than mine. I'm not a writer. But it fits in with the unconditional well-being that you're speaking of?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes. So the unconditional well-being, it keeps us available. The more we have that, the more we don't have to pull away from the unpleasant or grab the pleasant. And the more we don't have to contract into our story, the more we can rest in a general sense of connection in that way.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I like it. I don't know if I can do it, but I'll try.
Well, just be interested in when it's present. Just be interested in when, okay, is there a sense of well-being right now? Yes. So can I let that well-being, can I feel the, well, it does not have to be dependent. It does not have to be dependent.
As well, you know, sometimes
origination.
Sometimes I'm overwhelmed by other people's pain.
Of course.
And I've been noticing that lately. I have a friend who works with the homeless, and I can't bear listening to her because it's so painful. And the thing that has helped me the most is self-compassion.
Yes. Well, and it's so self-compassion is part of an appropriate response, and also the only listening to as much as you can handle is appropriate response. Mm. Yeah, very appropriate. So, Wendy, are you? Is it working now?
No. Thank you.
You're most welcome. All right, I'm going to go to the next screen over on my screen. Is there hands here? Looking for hands, the third screen.
Can I talk?
Yes, I don't know where you are right now, but yes, I'll come find you.
I'm somewhere in here.
I got you now.
Thank you so much. This was kind of what I needed to hear today, and I really appreciate it. I'm pretty new to this group and to this practice. Along the lines of what someone else was just talking about, every morning I've been reading the Buddha's words on loving kindness, and this one sentence just really pops out for me that says, "Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove." And it kind of ties in with what you were just talking about. I'm one of those people that's thriving in this situation. I am loving it. And yet there's this kind of nagging voice that tells me I'm not doing it right. I'm not, like you were saying, I'm not taking enough risk. I'm not giving enough, you know, like whatever that is. And so I just wonder if you have anything to say about that, because it's sort of that thing of, it can be judgment. It can feel judgy, you know, but I don't know, anything?
Yeah, so again, I'm glad this is coming up also. And the reason I brought it up this way is that the people that are actually thriving are a little embarrassed about it. And they're like, they feel guilty or ashamed, or they're confused, and they don't know, should I say to anybody that I'm actually enjoying this situation? And I understand that. I understand how that would be. And that's why I say that that's part of what you don't want. Your practice is to let, if you can thrive in this situation that you're in, thrive in it, but don't get attached to it so that you're seeing, okay, well-being because of conditions feels like this. What is well-being that's not based on conditions? That's the inner space. Then the outer space is, In these circumstances, out of my connection with others, how can I serve? Who do I know that would not be getting any phone calls? And call them so that you serve in ways small or large, depending on your conditions, but you don't just sit and enjoy yourself and not be of help to others. And a number of people are really isolated in a way that they need that kind of reaching out to. So that would be one thing to do. I don't know what else. I don't know your circumstances, what else you might do. But so you can, but there's no reason to be guilty or ashamed, because these kinds of situations where you're at home actually suit you. Mm-hmm. They suit many introverts to begin with, and people who are that way. And people who have had a lot of trauma, there's a certain amount, for some of those individuals, this situation actually is the most calming situation they've known, because they're not having to go out into the world where that those trauma things are stirred up, those propensities are stirred up. So there's not a special way you're supposed to be experiencing this. You experience it the way you are, and you use it to move towards the unconditional from the conditional. Does that help?
Yes, thank you.
Moving from the conditioned to the unconditioned as a direction.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you. I haven't found you yet.
Oh, here?
Let me move screens.
Why is it doing that? That's really weird.
Okay. Yeah.
What's this?
All right, I will do it without hearing you. Just go ahead.
You try this.
Now there. I can hear you. Now I've got you. Everything's good now. Yes.
Okay. So my question is kind of similar. In the beginning, I was worried about work and all that stuff, and then, you know, I got unemployment, so right away I calmed down so much I didn't realize that was so stressful. And then I've been like loving this time. I can do all these things from Spirit Rock and with you. And I am a little concerned, and I understand that when things go back, that I'm going to probably need to make some changes. But at some point I realized, you know, I'm spending more time in my garden and my husband and I are doing great. And I am a little concerned about, you know, when things go back.
Now, for some people, you may experience it as a loss going back. You may feel like this was kind of the time you've had your form of, on a personal level, a kind of paradise. You really got to be hidden away somewhere. Like you were the kind of vacation. Turns out that staycation was the very vacation that you had longed for all this time.
Yeah.
And then part of your practice is the letting go. When you come back, when the world comes back to its regular expectations, then you let go and you act appropriate at that time too. Although you and your husband can also choose to redefine how you meet the world in that way. Yeah. But then, and so again, this inner orientation towards the well-being, and then the outer orientation towards what's my appropriate response in relation to others. And so we carry both. We carry that question. Mm-hmm. I'm pointing to that it is not but it is not excluding others for the people who are the people from this is going well, and for the people whom this is really difficult. For neither cohorts do I think it's appropriate to exclude others. But we all
my niece, I've been in close contact with her. She lives in Brooklyn. She's a ICU nurse. And she was in, she has to take the subway to work. And she said the people were so much sicker and how afraid she was. And so that made it really, I understood, but it made it much more personal for me, mm-hmm. like what that would feel like. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I don't feel like I'm doing that. I mean, I have cut back on the news some just because it's crazy.
And that's appropriate. So yeah. this binging on the news, I question that there's balance in that. I understand the draw of it, but I don't really think it serves. One last question, then we got to move on.
Thank you.
There's a last question or comment. Yes, go ahead, Patty.
Thank you, Philip. It's so nice to have you back with us. I appreciate you taking the time. I was very touched by what you said about dukkha and how when we get angry about the way our leaders or other people are behaving or not behaving, it's very hard to take that anger and depersonalize it and just call it dukkha. And I understand the need to either vote out or fire people who are not helping. But making the dukkha less personal, that was very helpful to me. That was the first advice I got about this that really seemed doable. to just frame it as dukkha instead of getting into the story of how awful that particular dukkha is.
Yes, that's where our freedom lies in treating it as impersonal, but also it protects us from condemning others, you know, and to falling into hate. So we're protecting the sense gates as the Buddha asked us to do. We're protecting we're guarding the sense gates. And going back to the Karen's thing about that quote in the Metta about said that none would do nothing that the wise would disapprove of, is the it's because the world is getting, you know, we're getting more and more fractioned, you know, we're more and more into, you know, the technology is causing this really huge shadow of technology that was always there is now totally visible, about how easily it allows us to create a divisive world where, you know, in this conspiracy theory and all, where, you know, for us to not participate in the madness of that in a very conscious way, that alone is a contribution. So we don't fall into our little small, that way, a conspiracy theory that we believe in, you know, that we think, well, this one's okay. It's not like all those crazy conspiracy theories, but we it's just a theory, but nonetheless, we're believing it, you see. So we just don't participate in all that. Even though we don't know, we have our wonderings. You may still have wonderings about, really, did that guy sitting up there in the library on the fifth floor, whatever floor it was, really able to shoot Kennedy twice? You know, dubious. In some way, so it's fair to, one could ask that as a question, but the contracting into this conspiracy mind in any way, you know, it's bad enough out there without in terms of the unwholesome characteristics, without adding to it with all this conspiracy theory. So how do we not become afraid of it, you know? Well, it's through this having a well-being that we're not measuring our well-being by all these conditions. The conditions that are, the conditions that used to be, where those were hard or whatever, or the conditions that may be in the future. So I've had to work with a couple of individuals that were really convinced about how things are going to get so much worse. And they were really being miserable right now and doing some unskillful acts right now about this future that may or may not ever come about. And I go, but you're causing misery right now for something that you don't even know is going to happen. And if it were to happen, what you're doing now is not necessarily going to be a benefit to that. It's delusion. You know? So for us not to participate in that, we have the benefit of the Four Noble Truths. So the fact that there is dukkha, that this realm is like this, the second noble truth says that the practice of the 12 insights as described it. Sumedho describes the Venerable Sumedho and in his books and his teachings online. And I describe about that the teaching is to abandon the cause of suffering, to abandon that clinging, that thirsting about that. And you can do this every day. You can practice abandoning every day. We all can. I do. That's why I know we can. Because I do every day, and we all can equally. There's not a no one's more privileged than another, or something about that.
Thank you,
Patty.